The House Committee on Revenue for April 17, 2007 will come to order. We have five public hearings scheduled for today. Four of them are on four of them are on bills having to do with the Oregon inheritance tax. The fifth one is on a different topic. Because of the way in which the schedule for other members is working out today, I want to go ahead with the public hearing on the inheritance tax bills, with the understanding that we will temporarily close that hearing in order to hear the bill on intangible property when Representative Holvey is ready to appear on that bill. So we're going to open a public hearing now on House Bills 2817, House Bill 3256, House Bill 3411, House Bill 3430. There are some people who are signed up on both bills. I'm going to first take people who are more than 100 miles from home. I don't see anybody like that. I'm going to call people who seem to be signed up on multiple bills first. So let's hear from Barb Glaney.
Glancy.
Oh, that's a C, not an E. Thank you. Glancy. J.L. Wilson. I think those are the people who are signed up on the most bills. Please come forward. We will be getting a summary from the committee staff of these bills after more of the members are here. Thank you very much for coming today. Go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. I'm Barbara Glancy of Portland, Oregon, a retired federal employee, and I'm concerned about the growing gap between the wealthiest 1% of citizens and the lowest 80% of us. And I'm especially interested in the estate tax because the original intent was to protect the common people from the robber barons in the early part of the last century. And I represent the Estate Tax Coalition. And I applaud Representative Boquist for his removal of, I assume, all references to the state death tax. The state has never taxed anybody for dying. And it's been the purpose to tax those inheriting large estates to prevent most of its citizens from being controlled by those inheriting great wealth and the power that comes with it. And I must say, I was confused by this bill sneaking in the increase in the exemption level from $1 million to $2 million, and I only found that really in the table, which starts the taxation rates for states at $2 million. I have a federal pension, and that pension is increased every year by the cost of living, a COLA, so that I don't get poorer and poorer as time goes by. And the federal COLA is seldom over 3%. And my pension is far better than a lot of others, and there are even more people who don't even have any kind of a pension. And I find increasing the estate tax to $2 million indecent. It's more than 33 times the amount of cost adjustment that mine gets from being indexed by the COLA. I see no reason to raise the estate tax exemption to this level, especially since the state of Oregon broke the link between the state and the federal estate tax. So you're free to do what you want to do with that. I'm also confused by the table because it looks like it's applicable, and so does the text, for only 1 year, 2008.
And ma'am, which bill are you referring to?
I'm 2817.
Thank
I'm
you.
Sorry.
That's fine.
I should have begun with that.
You're doing fine.
Okay. And the reason, why I'm so upset by the increase in the exemption from $1 million to $2 million is that by doing so, you are losing $20 million in taxation. And I know that Oregon is doing better financially than it was in the last 4 or 5 years, but I don't think we're doing so well that we have to throw away $20 million, especially from people who are not exactly indigent. And I had a hard time reconciling the table with the additional text right after it until it finally dawned on me, and it didn't dawn on me until lunch today, that that reference to the $3.5 million was because it's going to raise the exemption level in 2009 to $3.5 million. And frankly, I don't have any figures on how much more than the $20 million you would be losing by doing that, but I'm sure it's a fair amount. Let's see now. Before that, the tax for 2009 was going to adjust to 16%. I read the AARP bulletin, and the bulletin for this month showed that Oregon ranked 39th from the top. That's 39 down from the highest per capita state and local taxes paid. The one who ranked first was the District of Columbia, and they don't even have a representative who can vote on taxes or anything. And so in Oregon, we are depending upon the people who are here in the legislature who do vote on the taxes to keep bills that are good and to keep ideas that are good, but not to raise the level so high that you're not getting any benefit from it. And then I looked at House Bill 3256. And it has, it doesn't remove the opprobrious death tax references. It does have the same increase in exemption. And then it comes to a part that's very interesting. It has 11 levels of adjusted taxable estates. And those levels are going to be treated in a progressive manner. The taxes are going to range from 1.5 addition over the existing tax to 13.19% for the very highest of the levels of taxation. The resulting tax rates would then be 5.55% for the lowest tax rate for the estate tax, and 29.19% for the very highest one. I am all for progressive taxation, so I want you to consider these tax levels very carefully. But I'm a little bit concerned about, and here I go against all of my progressive ideas in saying that I'm a little bit concerned that by doing by using the tax rates in 3256, the top level would be so high that it would be higher than the state of Washington, and someone told me recently it would be higher than all other states.
Mr. Chair, I'm confused. Is that on 3256?
Yes, 3256.
Representative Butler.
13.19% on these $10 million or more, not 30.
Yep. That's an additional tax, I believe.
Over compared to what?
Over the existing tax percentage, which is that's how I read it anyhow.
That's good. Okay, thank you. That's you're referring, I think, to line 8 and 9 on page 1.
Where I didn't bring the bill.
Where it says, in addition to and not in lieu of the tax imposed under ORS 118.010, there is imposed these additional taxes based on this table. And I'm not certain what 118.010 is, but I bet Mazin does.
It is the statute that specifies the connection to the federal tax code, Mr. Chair, where we pick up the Oregon share of the wealth tax.
Okay. Now, the federal code, if I understand it right, just excuse us just for a minute.
That's okay.
So we get this point.
It's informative.
The federal code's allowance of a credit for state inheritance taxes is going away, is it not?
That is correct, Mr. Chair. However, Oregon is connected to the 1997 federal tax code.
So we are assuming that there's a credit, even when there is, in fact, no credit any longer.
Well, there are credits, but the levels are different in the 2001 than
yes.
The 1997.
Thank you. Now I understand where she gets the argument about the rates. Do you, Representative Butler?
Yes, I think I do.
Thank you
very much.
Please proceed.
Okay, after you have explained what you just were talking about, if you were just talking about the rates being 1.5% in the lowest of the 11 levels that you proposed to 13.19%, that would be great because that would be progressive and it also wouldn't be higher than all other states. So this one is moving in a good direction except for the exemption levels.
Thank you very much. If you'll stay there for just a moment, we'll find out whether we have some questions for you. Are there questions for this witness? I guess not. Thank you very much. Mr. Wilson.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart and members. For the record, J.L. Wilson representing NFIB, or a business association of independent companies here in Oregon, about 12,000 strong. We've typically supported changes in Oregon's estate tax law that would increase the exemption level. I think the evidence today points to the fact that Oregon's exemption at $1 million is starting to tax people for whom the law was not meant to tax. That is to say, you're getting into a range of upper middle class folks who've accumulated that level of assets. I have a very personal connection with this law with two grandparents, but it illustrates exactly the situation they deal with kind of on the ground. One grandfather was over the $1 million threshold at about 1.3, I believe, and that consisted of his home. He moved into a law office, I believe, in the early 1970s and decided to purchase it. Plus, he had obviously some retirement, and the combination of those assets put him over the $1 million threshold, and he was just a very everyday type individual. Another grandfather for whom had majority ownership in the radio stations, you're talking about things that are material assets like translators and smart cast systems and towers, and I've given this spiel before so you know. But anyway, these are assets that produce middle-class income, but yet they are assets that have obviously over $1 million of value cumulatively. So that is how it affects small business people, everyday folks here in Oregon. I suspect that with housing values increasing as they are in the metro area, that this issue is starting to tax people just by virtue of the cost and price or value of real estate in the metro area. So our contention is that Oregon, while a good place, I believe, in my opinion, to accumulate assets, once you've accumulated those assets, I'd be careful of bills like 32 56 that purports to tax them disproportionate relative to other states because that wealth is mobile. You consider our 9% tax on capital gains, and I would not want to provide undue reason for folks to relocate once they have that level of assets. And so that's something I would ask you to be cognizant of. But that's the application of the estate tax as it pertains to the folks that I represent, and I'm happy to answer questions. Oh, and by virtue of explanation on the bill, we support 3430, I believe it is. That's just the cleanest application. It moves up the exemption level to $2 million. I believe 2817 purports to move it to $2 million next year and 3.5, which is consistent with where the federal exemption is headed. I was not sure whether the tax table in 2817 was a new tax table or whether you were transferring the existing tax table into that statute. But regardless, we are just more in favor of a cleaner application in terms of increasing the exemption level.
Thank you. Are there questions for Mr. Wilson? Thank you very much. We appreciate your attendance and patience today with the committee given our scheduling problem. Let's hear next from David Bean and David Booth. I think that's right. And you gentlemen have signed up on House Bill 2817.
Yeah, I was lazy. I didn't sign up on all of
that's
them.
That's fine. You may speak about any of them.
Okay. Thank you. I'm David Bean. I'm a carpenter from Portland. And I've been concerned about the... I'm a carpenter with a background in economics, which makes me kind of a funny guy. An economist with some common sense, perhaps.
Ooh. Hewitt Mazin can have a conversation after the meeting. Yes.
I'm also an old-fashioned Republican of the Teddy Roosevelt sort. Why do we have an estate tax? Well, originally we had it to pay. There was a war going on, and it needed to be paid for. And the Republican administration at the time thought that those that gained the most from society had the most to preserve, because they had the most to protect. And so they felt that those people ought to pay for that protection. There's a sound logic to that. Does, aside from collecting money, does it have a, does the estate tax or death tax or whatever you wish to call it have an economic function? And this is what draws me here. It's not the matter. I'm not really concerned about the amount of money it raises. I'm looking at the effect of the tax. And my notion of its history and its reason for being is to spread opportunity. We have geniuses that create things like Microsoft. Bill Gates has spawned, I don't know, maybe 1,000 millionaires. That's pretty good for being a billionaire to create that many millionaires. Locally, we have Phil Knight. I don't think he's created that many. He hasn't spread it around in the same way. Of course, his scale of development is a little larger. But the good thing is to spread it around. Now, after Bill Gates goes, that doesn't mean that his wonderful children are going to be as smart in the same way that he is. I mean, it takes... There's many ways of being brilliant. Not all of them bring returns. We, people with economics backgrounds, know this. Because there's not very many rich economists. Anyway, being cutting to the chase, there's this graph here describing wealth distribution or wealth inequity, and it looks there are two different topics on this one paper. The graph on the bottom is the wealth distribution as of 2001, and the text is a little later than that. That's 2003. This graphic shows that the bottom quintile has zero or negative wealth, and moving up to the top 80%, it's still a very slim value. What we know today is that 30%, this is in the United States, I don't have the data for Oregon itself, 30% of people who file their income tax file it for $30,000 or less. So we go up to the, so that would be halfway between the 40th and the 50th on your graph, just about the center of that graph. And then up at the 80th percentile, so four-fifths of the population is below $90,000. So it's only at the very top, the top 1%, you see this huge breadth of wealth, and that is more than functional. This goes beyond stuff. This reaches into social control when the fortunes get as large as is in the top 1%. Going to the text above that was researched by David K. Johnson of the New York Times, who wrote the book Perfectly Legal and is their tax reporter. He shows that from 1991, the concentration of corporate wealth was at 38% for the top 1% of the population, and that has grown in 2003 to 53%. Over half of the wealth of the corporate wealth was controlled by that top 1%, and then in the ensuing 1 year between 2002 and 2003, it jumped up to 57.5%.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
Thank you. If I may, Mr. Chair, as I look at this, excuse me, Mr. Bean, this is most instructive because I had a question for our economist mm-hmm. here at the dais regarding wealth and how we calculate wealth in Oregon. This calculates wealth in a different manner. But do I read in the beginning of the second paragraph of this handout, in 2003 the incomes of the top 1% ranged from $237,000 to several billions of dollars? That's the income range?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and that's the top 1%.
Right.
Do we have actual calculation of the wealth of the top 1%? I've had clients that can make $500,000 to $1 million a year and have bank cards maxed out.
Right.
No wealth at all other than what they've got in their home.
Right.
Do you have any information about the actual wealth?
It varies. I can say per individual. I mean, because you're very correct. The relationship between income and wealth is idiosyncratic, and especially with the savings rate of Americans.
Negative. So the question, Mr. Chair, is, do we know, other than just from income, do we know what the wealth is of this top 1%? Is there any way to track that?
Representative, I think NASA may have some information about that, and if not, I'm aware of the fact that the statistics are being kept, and we can certainly get them. I saw a table yesterday that purported to be on the distribution of wealth in 2001, which is in a different form than this table, but the numbers, I think, are the same. And that has to do with ownership of property, not with income.
And, Mr. Chair, if $250,000 it brings someone to the top 1% of true assets, of net assets.
Actually, this is income we're talking about.
I realize that, but if 250,000 is the value, then everyone that owns a home in Oregon, the average home in Oregon, I think is somewhere between $237,000 to $277,000 in value. So everybody that would own a home, assuming it's eventually free and clear, would be in the top 1%. But I don't know what
Representative, I think you're mixing
income
and wealth.
With
wealth. Those are different ideas.
Right, and that's why I'm looking for the actual
I think
wealth.
To be in the top 1% for wealth, you'd have to have a lot more money than a $250,000 house.
Okay, and that's where I was trying to go.
Yes, I can.
Bottom is wealth. This is income here, but this is
well,
wealth.
In a minute, we'll get you in just a minute, yes. If you can conclude, that would be very helpful.
Okay. Just if I can reflect on this.
Yes.
This dramatic graph was produced by Professor Edward Wolfe of I think it's New York University, and I've been in touch with him asking for a more recent date, and it is a map of wealth, but I don't have the. It's hard to get current figures on this stuff. So, yes, I do want to conclude. And I'm concluding with the notion of what's this could be called the margarita of wealth. If you look at it, it's a very thin drink. It used to be a lot deeper drink. Some people say that they would like to see more of a martini of wealth, if you see the shape of that, or even a pilsner of wealth. So that more people are involved, and the reason for that is that there's more prosperity when we can trade with each other as opposed to seek jobs from large corporations, which is becoming more so. So what's the tendency of this graph as you look at it is to become thinner at the top.
Yeah,
and the only
Mr. Bean, it would be very helpful if you could make the one or two points you want to make yet and conclude. Thank you.
The relationship between the top and the stem of this graph is largely a function of tax policy, and estate tax policy is in the number of bills that we signed up for was going in exactly the wrong direction, in my estimation, if we want to create prosperity. If we want prosperity, we want more people involved in the generation of wealth. So my concluding remark would be that to raise the threshold of the the inheritance tax would do nothing but make this graph continue to be more separated of the wealthy and the rest of us. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Booth.
Thank you. And for the record, I'm David Booth with Tax Fairness Oregon. That's an all-volunteer citizens group ensuring that taxes fall fairly and are evenly enforced. David's been talking about the wealth divide. It's another form of a double standard we have. And unfortunately, today in Oregon, we seem to be going the wrong way, kind of backwards in taxes. We have a bunch of bills trying to reduce or eliminate the effect of estate tax again. These are factors we all know well, but it's easy to lose track of the relative magnitude of these numbers we are talking about. So David already covered the first elephant in the room, the rapidly going wealth gap, and I'm here to talk about the size of the money that we're talking about sort of trading or bargaining with. We've been talking about raising the corporate minimum to, say, $800, and that would bring in 25,000 corporations times $800 would bring in about $20 million. But if we turn around and increase the deduction for the estate tax, we would be giving that $20 million right away, straight away, to the richest 300 families in Oregon. So 25,000 corporations gives $20 million to 300 families. It seems hardly fair. So that's one way of looking at what we're talking about when we change the exemption on the estate taxes. The second elephant in the room, I'll direct you to page 3 of our handout. We tried to put historical sense on the taxes over virtually almost the whole century. You can see here we've prepared every 5 years numbers of the tax rates, the state taxes for the U.S. And a few things to notice is that there's been a rather clear historical tax range. This is the taxes of the estate taxes, and what portion of the population is paying them. So we've been comfortably between 1% and 2% most of the time, and you can see we rose out from the 50s to the 70s very strongly because we left the exemption level alone for 40 years. And then again we rose out when we didn't address the exemption level later, after it had been increased by 10 times, by the way. So now we are talking about, in 2004 for the federals, raising the deduction to $1.5 million, and you can see the 2004 bar is slipping right out of that range. And there's even talk, and I guess the feds have gone ahead and put it at $3.5 million, so we're going to drop. I mean, it's historically off the chart. It's not like anything before. And finally, I'd like to point out that in Oregon, we have broken, like many other states, we've stayed with the $1 million exemption level, not following the federals. And at that level, we're very comfortably in a nice range here, just over 1%. So, and there's a bunch of other states with the same exemption. So what we're here today to really propose to address this issue is that since Oregon is right about the right spot right now with its deductions, we think that we should create a bill and make it tie the inheritance, the estate taxes, to the opportunity for those less fortunate. We believe that those who are the most fortunate in society are in the best position to help those who are the least fortunate. So we feel that tying it to the educational opportunity would be a great theme. So in particular, we'd like to see House Bill 3430 modified to leave the estate exemption at $1 million and begin indexing it, just like we do minimum wage or the COLA things. It's in a good spot now, and it would follow. And the second thing we could do is we could direct these proceeds to Oregon community colleges or other educational and low-income or opportunity grants and things. So that's what we're here to present. We wrote some whereas. We'd like to tax the largest 1% to 2% just to pick kind of a fair range. And we'd like to make Oregon's commitment to shared opportunity. And we would like to make sure that no other taxpayers are more uniquely appropriate to grant opportunity to those less fortunate to themselves. So we wrote a sample bill.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. We'll call Joe Messette. Thank you, gentlemen.
We're done.
Thank you.
Jeff Stone and Daryl Fuller.
Chair Barnhart and members of the House Revenue Committee, for the record, my name is Jill Meshack. I'm a policy analyst with the Oregon Department of Forestry. I understand time is of the essence. I'm speaking in regard to House Bill 3256, but my comments are sort of generally towards inheritance taxes or estate taxes. On behalf of the Department of Forestry, I'd like to express concern over the effect increasing estate taxes can have on private woodland management in Oregon, particularly on family forest land ownerships. In my testimony, I outline sort of the long-term nature of the crop. I've worked in southern Oregon, in the Medford area, and over in eastern Oregon. And there it takes generally between 60 to 90 years to plant a tree and grow it to maturity. On the west side, you're looking more around 50 years of age, 50 to 70 years of age. The point I make in the testimony is that how many owners does it take to tend that crop versus how many of those that actually share in or enjoy the wealth that comes. You know, on the west side, it's 1 in 3. If you went to eastern Oregon, where it takes maybe up to 90 years for rotation, you might be looking at 1 in 5 owners. You'd have 5 owners that are moving along and tending, and only one of them would actually reap the benefit of harvesting the tree. I also point out in the testimony that there are negative impacts that might occur related to premature harvest if estate taxes have to be paid, and that's the only form of wealth that the woodland owner has to pay the estate taxes, and also the loss of the public values that come from just as the tree is growing more wood or is producing more clean air or is sequestering more carbon. They have to harvest those trees, so we recognize there's public values. I provided another handout to the committee that just is a tax handout that I hand out to woodland owners, a one-pager that quickly lets them know the property tax system for forest land. And on that, there are two programs that the Oregon legislature also recognizes the value of good tax policy. And there are two programs called the Forest Land Tax Program, and then also an option that recognizes that it's called the Small Woodland Owner Option, that recognizes that small woodland owners sort of operate on a different economic scale than larger landowners. Under that program, small woodland owners pay 20% of their property tax annually, and at the time they harvest or sever the trees and actually have some money in pocket, they pay a severance tax to sort of make up for the other 80% that was deferred. So I point out your own tax policy related to woodlands and the difference between large owners and small owners. And I just sum up by saying that I'd like to encourage the committee to consider the long-term nature of forest land investment, the many public values that come from good stewardship of forest land, and the potential impact increasing estate taxes can have to the management of both industrial and non-industrial lands. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Misak?
Thank you, Chair.
Yes, Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, I just want to make sure that I understand the point of your testimony, Mr. Misak. Relative to the small woodlands operations, even though it may take a few generations to actually grow a harvestable product, there's still greater equity in collecting 20% of the current property tax annually and paying the severance tax. Is that your opinion at this point?
Well, Chair Barnhart and Representative Butler, point of my testimony is that the small woodland owners, through that policy, are recognized as having different economic constraints and that they only have income periodically that comes through. I think earlier you were talking about capital and being able to tax it. They also have the whole issue of liquidity, you know, in terms of when the size of the timber finally reaches merchantable, then it's liquid, but it's really just starting to put on a fair amount of wood at that point in time. And so the point of my testimony is both that we have tax policy in Oregon that recognizes the special economic situation that small woodland owners face, but also that there are public values even on industrial ownerships that accrue by having this done in a timely fashion or collecting tax at a time when owners can appropriately pay it or can afford to pay it. So my only point is maybe caution in terms of looking at how this policy affects forestry to where our future generations can enjoy as much from our forests as we can possibly give them.
Mr. Chair, and I want to just make sure that I understand, under current tax law, Oregon recognizes the deferrals for certain types of family-owned businesses, including farms and forest lands, under 2032A and the other kinds of tax deferrals, death tax deferrals. Is that still correct?
Under 2030, you mean the new proposal?
He's talking about an Internal Revenue Code provision.
Right. The Oregon still recognizes that, which would include these small woodlots.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Yes, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jeff Stone, the Director of Government Relations for the Oregon Association of Nurseries. We are your largest agricultural sector with over $1 billion in sales each year. a little sense of what agriculture brings to the Oregon economy is that we've had steady growth over the past two decades and is a major part of the economy, $4 billion with impact of over $12 billion annually. Our industry is built on a foundation of hard work, one fraught with risks, and provides one of every 12 jobs in the state. At the state and federal level, discussions of the estate tax focus particular attention on effects on family businesses, including farms. As policymakers, you must balance the revenue needs of the state with the tax that may unfairly burden businesses, family businesses in particular. This burden is mainly due to the fact that much of the estate value is held in illiquid assets, meaning land, buildings, and equipment. It's our view that the estate tax forces these businesses to liquidate vital assets in order to pay the tax. What the state and federal legislators often face is an outright call for repeal of the estate tax. We're not advocating that here. We are supporting a common sense tax policy to keep farms within a family. One interesting note is over 600 of our 1,500 members for our association would be classified as a small agricultural operation. Well, now what does that mean? That means that their gross income is under $250,000 in sales. In agriculture, that doesn't take much to get there. On the other side, just to give you the complete picture, we have 40 members that exceed $5 million. In sales a year. So I just want to make sure that I bracket that accurately for you. That is one of the strengths of this industry, is the mix of type of growers that we have and the type of products that we grow. The refinement of the estate tax is a top priority for the Nursery Association. We advocate a reasoned tax structure and support family agricultural operations in the state. For this reason, we are supportive of House Bill 3430 that's before you today. Raising the exemption to $2 million would help many of our medium and small growers. Helping family farms and nurseries continue to be a generational industry is a service to agriculture and to the state of Oregon. Though Ann feels that House Bill 3430 makes a significant step towards preserving family businesses and urges the committee's support. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much. Mr. Fuller.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Darrell Fuller with the Oregon Independent Auto Dealers Association. I want to start out by mentioning that when I put my tie on this morning, I didn't realize it was OSU Day at the Capitol, and I want to make sure that nobody thinks that there isn't an academic purpose to wearing a yellow tie, and I don't want to offend anybody on the committee.
Some of us appreciate yellow tie.
Yeah. And I was going to say, and by saying that, I don't wish to offend the chair, who I know comes from that area, so I just didn't check the... check the schedule for today. I'm testifying in favor of House Bill 3430, which does increase the threshold from $1 million to $2 million. Would like to, beyond that, suggest that we believe that a reconnection to the federal tax code would be beneficial in that there is an administrative cost every time the state of Oregon disconnects from the federal code in terms of small businesses doing their taxes. The more there's a disconnect, the more difficult it is for small businesses, and the more work is required in order to complete their taxes correctly. So we support generally just being connected to the federal tax code whenever possible. In the industry that I represent, auto dealers, we are finding, especially over the last two or three years, the value of the property on which our dealerships sit, including the improvements we make with the dealership, the buildings and so forth that we have on the dealership property, sometimes can take us over that $1 million threshold just in the property. And it doesn't necessarily matter how many cars we sit on it or how many cars we sell in a year. The fact that we made a good land acquisition maybe a generation or two generations ago, and because the cities have grown up around us, we find ourselves with incredibly valuable pieces of property that we have no intent to sell because we want to keep the dealership into the third and the fourth generation. And so my concern is, as we look at the price of the price and value of property increasing significantly, for some small businesses. It captures them in some ways, as Mr. Wilson spoke earlier, where you're necessarily not talking about liquid dollars. So moving from the $1 million to the $2 million threshold, I think, would help a number of businesses under those circumstances. Beyond that, when you get into family businesses where there is some accumulated wealth and some success, you also find more and more often that they're going to have properties in more than one state. A number of dealers who are successful in their businesses in second and third generations will have a home in California or a second home in Arizona or other locations. If the inheritance tax in Oregon becomes substantially different than the inheritance tax in other states, that inheritance becomes portable, and that it's very easy for them to simply switch their residence to a different state and remove that taxable event out of Oregon completely. And so I think it would be important for us to be careful and make sure that our tax policy with regard to inheritance is not substantially out of line with our neighboring states. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Representative Butler, I'm wondering if we can hold off. We are running out of time today. We will be leaving with this subject again. I would like to hear from Representative Hanna, who I think is here on this subject, and then I would like to have a hearing, a short hearing, on a bill that Representative Holley has brought, and so we're running short of time. I would be amazed, representatives, if we don't hear from this topic again this session. Is that okay with you if we go ahead?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The question I had, I don't need them to answer it right now, is they've all talked about moving forests, nurseries, and car dealerships, the second and third generation. If that's the case, I'd kind of like to know something more about how many of these businesses are actually staying in the same families from generations to generations.
And that would be a good topic for a short paper that you gentlemen might want to prepare for us.
We'll work together.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Representative Hanna.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Chairman, committee members. For the record, I'm Bruce Hanna, State Representative, House District 7. Mr. Chairman, on behalf of our caucus, of which all 29 members are sponsors of House Bill 3430, thank you for hearing House Bill 3430 today. We appreciate greatly the attention the Revenue Committee has given to the important issue of bringing estate tax relief to Oregon families, farmers, and other small business owners. Mr. Chairman and committee, House Bill 3430 deserves strong consideration and passage this session in order to bring Oregon's estate tax in line with federal tax law. Since 2006, federal tax law has exempted estates under $2 million from estate taxes, while Oregon's exemption has remained at $1 million. This has and will continue to cost hundreds of Oregon families tens of thousands of dollars a year. There are many examples of families who have been forced to sell homes, small businesses, and farms, or regrettably go deeply into debt in order to pay their estate tax. I'm sure you will hear more of these stories as our discussions on estate tax continue during this session. House Bill 3430 begins to address this problem by increasing Oregon's estate tax exemption to $2 million effective January 1st, 2007. This is a good first step toward bringing Oregon's estate tax in line with federal law. In 2009, the federal exemption will rise to $3.5 million, and in 2010, the federal estate tax will be eliminated altogether. Our caucus strongly supports the concept of estate tax reform by increasing the exemption and moving toward reconnecting with the federal tax law. Mr. Chairman, I know this committee is having ongoing discussions about corporate tax reform and tax expenditure reform with a goal of increasing fairness in Oregon's tax code. The estate tax, often referred to by its critics as the death tax, is one of our least fair taxes. It taxes those who have worked, saved, and paid taxes, income, property, and other taxes all their lives. I would urge this committee to consider estate tax reform as part of making our tax system much fairer. And before I close, the most common asset in a taxable estate is a primary residence or other real property. In Oregon, during the past 5 years, housing prices have increased by an average of 60%. As this trend continues, more and more Oregonians will find themselves affected by our current estate tax unless we pass House Bill 3430. So with that, I would urge your support for House Bill 3430, and again, thank you for the opportunity to present.
Thank you, Representative. Are there questions we're dying to ask now? Thank you very much.
Thank
we
you.
Appreciate your testimony. We're going to close the open public hearings, and we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2793. Representative Holby.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Paul Holby, State Representative, District 8. I'm bringing House Bill 2793 before you, just real simply. This bill addresses an issue that I became aware of last session when we had a bill that exempted some public utilities in Washington from paying tax for use of the Northwest Intertie. And I became concerned about that in my own area and started checking in to find out whether or not people in Oregon pay this tax. And indeed, I found out a lot of consumers in Oregon do pay this tax. And it just kind of rubbed me the wrong way, I guess, that we're exempting people in Washington for what I think is probably a good reason. But we're still ongoing. We're charging Oregon consumers this same tax. So it was in fairness. I don't believe it amounts to a lot of money. I think that I just didn't understand why we would charge Oregon electrical consumers a tax that we're exempting consumers in the state of Washington from paying. And so that is essentially the essence of this bill. There is a reference in the bill and in my testimony to similar electrical transmission lines, which may actually need to be amended out. It wasn't my intent to put that in there. I'm not really sure what similar electrical transmission lines I'm speaking of there. So just a little technical glitch, I guess, in the bill as it's written. So it's basically a simple concept of this intangible tax, I suppose, of taxing electricity that's coming through a line from a certain provider to a certain consumer. And in fairness, I think we ought to be treating Oregonians fairly as well.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Berger.
Yeah, I have a question, and it may not be directed at Representative Holby, maybe a staff-related question, but I want to make it clear that we're talking about electricity here over lines, because it's possible to have broadband over lines like this, and are they going to be exempt under this, or are we talking strictly about electrical transmission?
I think that's an excellent question as we look at the technical aspects of the bill.
Well, I think this bill specifically addresses the Northwest Intertie transmission line, which is a Pacific Northwest AC Intertie, which is an electrical transmission line.
But the city, county, people, utilities, districts that are also referenced, I just want to be sure we're talking about electrical transmission and would not include or specifically preclude other things that go across these lines, such as broadband.
Mary?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, yes. Yeah.
And Mr. Chair, I have one other comment to make, if you don't mind.
Please.
There is nobody can miss the statement of that tie.
And some of us appreciate it very much.
Okay.
Representative Berger. Thank you, Representative Holby. We appreciate it very much. And your testimony as well. Yes, and Mary's going to give us a summary, and while she does, I would ask that Sandy Flicker and John, is it Whistler, come forward.
So you're done with me? Thank you.
We are. Thank you.
Thank you very much,
Representative.
Chair and committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2793 is connected in a way to a bill that was enacted during the prior session. And at that time, it was a bill that pertained to this transmission line, the Pacific Northwest Intertie, which is an electric line. And it was running, it was taking excess power from a city-owned electric utility in Washington State and passing it through to, let's say, California. So there was no actual nexus in Oregon. The concept was to exempt that city-owned facility from paying property tax here in Oregon. But as I recall, going through the data, there was one cooperative located in Oregon that wasn't included. It was Oregon-based, so the nexus is here, so they were left with the tax to pay. And the bill is written... did have some concerns. I think the Department of Revenue might mention it about the inclusion of the similar electric, because it was specific at the time to the Northwest Intertie.
Thank you very much. Yes, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sandy Flicker, and I'm representing the Oregon Rural Electric Cooperative Association. And I have with me today Mr. John Whistler, who is with Power Resources Cooperative, who will be actually giving the technical part of this presentation. But first, I want to thank you for hearing the bill. I know we're getting to the point in session where it's important, if you want a bill scheduled, it's very important that you do that. So thank you very much for hearing the bill. And we will be very brief today, because truly this is an issue that was fairly thoroughly discussed last session, and as exactly has been portrayed, the electric cooperatives were left out of Senate Bill 31 last session. And clearly the issue is that there is a third AC intertie line that travels through Oregon. And it is a line that is owned by the Bonneville Power Administration. So the state of Oregon is not able to tax that line because it's owned by the federal government, so there's a use tax or an intangible tax for the use of that line. And last session, there were three utilities from Washington, two municipal utilities, and a PUD from the state of Washington who had a contract to wheel power over that line, and they did pay a tax, and they were exempt from that tax. And there were several different bases for the argument. It sort of did change as we moved through session. Started out with just being a municipal to municipal issue, Washington, Oregon, and then we got a Snohomish PUD involved, so all of a sudden we had a different basis for the reason for the exemption. The Rural Electric Co-op Association did not bring that bill forward last session and would probably not have brought that bill forward last session. However, when we saw that this bill was being expanded and there were more and more folks that were requesting an exemption from this tax, we decided that we did need to represent our customers fairly and ask for that exemption from that tax as well. That did not happen last session. The two municipal utilities from Washington and the PUD from Washington did receive an exemption from paying this use tax on the third AC intertie line that goes through Oregon. So we... However, knowing that there was going to be yet another legislative session in a couple of years, decided that we were inequitably situated in this tax policy, and we did need to bring it to the attention of the legislature, and we did need to request your support for giving us equity in terms of a tax policy in Oregon. And we are asking for an exemption for electric cooperatives from this tax so that they will be similarly situated with the other consumer-owned utilities that are now exempt from this tax. So that is the basis of this legislation, that it's an equity issue. It is has very little fiscal impact because of the size of co-ops and our contract on that line. So we're really here to just ask for your support for equity for electric cooperatives, both customers, both in-state and out-of-state. And I'm going to let Mr. Whistler now provide the technical testimony, because he is with the organization that does have the co-op organization that does have the contract for the use of this line, and they and those co-ops are the ones who do pay the tax. So with that, I'll give you Mr. Whistler.
Thank you, Mr. Whistler.
And thus we are cutting the check. So yes, thank you very much for the opportunity to be here. My name is John Whistler, and I'm representing Power Resources Cooperative, which is a power cooperative based in Portland, Oregon. I'm going to kind of follow along generally with the testimony that I submitted. I might indicate I was shocked and chagrined to find out it was OSU Day today, because they were jokingly telling me yesterday at my office I was not allowed to wear my Benny Beaver outfit down here today. So I had no clue it was OSU Day, or I would have been appropriately dressed. So my apologies to the chair if that's offensive. In any event,
and the chair actually is quite pleasant.
A little bit of background. PRC is a not-for-profit generation transmission cooperative that was organized under Oregon Statute Chapter 62, 1976. This was in order to meet the perceived power supply needs of its members due to Bonneville's notice of insufficiency that was issued in 1975. We are owned by 13 member distribution cooperatives, seven of whom serve customers in Oregon. In fact, that is the majority of the end-use customers served. Other members serve retail customers in Idaho, Washington, Montana, Wyoming, Utah, and Nevada.
And I note that you're reading your testimony. What would be really helpful for us is if you could hit the high points.
Okay.
And I expect the committee members to read the testimony and give it to us in this form, and we do appreciate it very much.
Okay. Well, let's see, I'm just kind of trying to give you a little background on the entity. And once again, we own two primary assets, and that would be the Boardman coal plant out in eastern Oregon that is majority owned and operated by Portland General Electric. We have a 10% interest in that. And we also own and operate the Coffin Butte landfill methane gas facility down by Corrales, Oregon. In addition, we have a small commercial real estate investment that's through a wholly owned subsidiary. So we purchased the rights to transmit on the third AC intertie between Pacific Northwest and California in order to transmit electricity. We have the right to schedule up to 50 megawatts, although it's based on capability of the line, and in fact the line has been kind of officially derated ever since we got into the contract, starting in 1996 with some of the rolling brownouts, if you recall, that took place across the rest of that year. None of our members have an actual ownership interest in this asset. This is strictly contractual, and is very similar to a large prepayment made on a transmission wheeling agreement. As Sandy indicated, the lines are owned, operated, and maintained by the federal government. Since we purchased the rights to use this capacity and enter into the contract with Bonneville, we have had to pay property taxes under regulations adopted by the Department of Revenue with the state. And for the most recent tax years, approximated about $65,000 per our analysis, which is somewhat difficult to make a direct correlation between actual asset values and the way the centrally assessed property rules work. And this amount is effectively an obligation of our members and is imposed upon them. And as Sandy indicated, the last session you passed Senate Bill 31, which exempted three out-of-state consumer-owned utilities from paying taxes on their respective shares of this contract, and yet PRC and its members are still required to pay taxes on a similar share of the intertie. And we submit that this is indeed inequitable, and therefore we support House Bill 2793, proposes that all consumer-owned utilities, including PRC and its Oregon out-of-state members, are given the same exemption for property taxes related to the intertie. And that's the extent of my comments. Do you have any questions?
Thank you. Questions for this panel?
Sure.
Yeah, Representative Butler.
Do we have many more signed up on this one?
We do. We have the AOC and also the Department of Revenue.
Okay. Mr. Chair, my recollection is that the Snohomish and City Power, Seattle City Power and Tacoma, none of them had a business nexus in the state of Oregon, but the PRC does have some business nexus in the state of Oregon.
Yes, we do.
And actually owns property in the state of Oregon. But you are nonprofit. All of these are nonprofit organizations.
Correct. We and our members.
So in that regard, similar to this Snohomish PUD, which is a nonprofit, it would put you on the same footing as that PUD, because the others are actual municipal organizations.
Correct.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We'll hear from the counties and from the department. I think counties first, probably.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Gilbert Hill Association of Oregon Counties. This bill provides me the first opportunity of the session, which is now half over, of course, to discuss the effects of new property tax exemptions and to suggest a test if you wish to consider them. Under Oregon's rate-based property tax system, of course, a new exemption is a direct loss of revenues for public services such as public safety and education. As a consequence, ALC respectfully requests that you provide a high standard for granting any proposed tax exemption, and we've provided five bullets there in the middle of my sheet, single sheet, as a suggested test. Briefly, has the stated need for the exemption been clearly demonstrated by objective data? And that need is on purpose. It's not a want. It's a need. Has the property tax exemption been objectively shown to directly address the need? Are there alternative means to address the stated need other than a new property tax exemption? On balance, is the exemption genuinely worth its cost to the essential public services? And will there be periodic review of the performance? Is this the appropriate vehicle to provide for the need, and will you check to see if that's the case? We would suggest that if a new proposed exemption doesn't meet this test, that it not be granted. We also asked you to please be mindful to the legislative declaration on the books since 1999 that new property tax exemptions will be funded at 50% of its cost to general local governments. This is to be accomplished by payments to an account or by expiration of other property tax exemptions. As your partners in delivery of public services to the same constituency, we respectfully request that you continue to take great care before further limiting the already cut and capped property tax revenues that pay for important public services. With that, I'm finished, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Questions for the counties? I suspect there will be some. I personally appreciate your proposed a statement of a standard, and we'll certainly look at it. Mr. Phillips.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Phillips, the Oregon Department of Revenue. Thank you. The department is neutral on this bill in terms of the policy. The department is involved because we do appraise the property, and therefore we do have an interest in it. House Bill 2793 proposes to add electric cooperatives to the list of municipal corporations that are currently exempt from the use of the property known as the Pacific Northwest Intertie. Additionally, it would exempt similar electric transmission lines to which there's been a comment earlier. I chatted on the phone with Sandy and Mr. Whistler, and we've talked about what that might be, and they didn't know what it referred to, possibly something from legislative council. We didn't know what it meant, and we've agreed that it could be just amended out and clarify the bill. Well, that would help us. Also conclude with Representative Berger that it doesn't mean something else that no one's really aware of, like broadband. So we're looking forward to an amendment that might do that, and that would help us understand what the bill is trying to do. Another point is that there are four companies the department assesses for the use of the tangible property that is the Pacific Northwest Intertie. Those are Power Resources Cooperative, PGE, Puget Sound Energy, and Pacific Core. That's down from seven from last session. So we have, with this exemption, there will be just three left. Just so that you're aware, those are the only entities. So the provisions in the bill that exempt cities and counties will have absolutely no effect because none of them are and currently own or use the property. The bill also exempts certain PUDs, none of which in Oregon is assessed for the property. So that part of the bill will have, you know, no effect at this time. The reference to intangible property is interesting, but it really is not. What we're talking about is transmission lines, substations, transformers, and the like. They're all tangible assets in this case. The bill does reference a lot of other things because we wanted, last session when we were discussing this concept, we wanted to be sure that everything possible in the entire universe of taxability was included because of contracts that we may not even know about or relationships or rights. But what happens in this case and what happened in last session's case and for these other three entities is that they used property that does not belong to them. Use in Oregon is taxable, and so this is tangible property. And that might be a distinction without a difference for your purposes, but since I keep hearing people refer to it, I always feel compelled to talk about that. So Finally, I mentioned that. And that is it. We've talked with Power Resources, Sandra and John, at length about what the value of this might be. Because we do not value centrally assessed property as discrete parts of property, like this power pole is worth this much and this land or substation is worth this or this business office is worth that. We value that company as an operating unit, as an entire entity. We cannot now tell you the value of this exemption, but the testimony that was given earlier is probably very close to what it is, and what we will end up doing is probably taking whatever value that they book for that asset and then either adjusting it for depreciation or appreciation and then subtracting that. That's how we will probably implement this legislation if it passes. And that's all I have to say. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions, Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John, using tangible property in Oregon is taxable to the user. It's one of the things that you're saying. Is also taxable under current law.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, for centrally assessed property, that is absolutely true. The use, the word use or usage is used 43 times in the central assessment statutes, and that's exactly what it's referring to. So you don't have to own the property to be subject to taxation for central assessment.
So if I can follow up on that,
please.
Centrally assessed properties include airports or airline facilities. So if I'm a user of those airline facilities, I pay a tax as a user on those as well?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, central assessment in the statutes, it refers to those companies or services that are related to air transportation, you're right, electrical generation or transmission, communications, and water transportation, gas lines, and rail. For example, that's not exhausted, but that's generally the list, yes. So if they were to use, for example, public property or other private, other someone else's private property, that use would be taxable. Yes.
And you're taxing an organization like this as a whole, as an entity, and then apportioning it over the counties where it does business.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Follow up, Mr.
Yes, please,
Chair.
Representative Butler.
My concern is that here what's happening is that if the Northwest Intertie was in fact private as opposed to federally owned, if it was privately owned, it would be taxed as a privately owned facility. Isn't that correct, John?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, if it was privately owned by someone other than Power Resources Cooperative, you mean?
Or other than the federal government, to put it in.
Yes, in any case, it would be taxable.
Okay. And my concern then is that if it is being taxed to the first user and then subsequent use, including any extraordinary use of it, that is running, if they need power run across it 20 hours a day, then it's taxed for its full value to the first to the owner, and then it's subsequently taxed to a subsequent user of it. Is that
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler? I think a good analogy might be like an apartment building that's owned or a office building that's owned by a private concern. That private concern leases various square footage to private entities, and they also, like a CPA firm, for example, or something like that, and they also lease to, let's say, a municipality for a little maybe permit office or something. That's where the use concept comes in. Privately owned, if it's used by a municipality for municipal purposes, then it's exempt under 307090. That's the statute's amending here. So it's the use concept. If it's used for municipal purposes, it's exempt. Then the owner has not been double taxed for that. I mean, it's not taxed twice. It's that space is assigned to the user just like you would if you leased property. It's not taxed to the lessee and the lessor at the same time. I hope that is getting to where your line of questioning is leading.
It does begin to get to it. My concern is my understanding is that with regard to the Pacific Northwest Intertie, what's happening is it's the excess capacity on the intertie that's being charged, and again, if it was owned by a private entity, they would be paying the basic property tax on it, and then if somebody else came and used it part time then you're sending out an additional property tax bill and saying, okay, yes, we are collecting all of the taxes on it over here, but now you're a user of it, so we're going to collect the taxes just as if you were a brand new user, a brand new co-owner of it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I think that's probably getting beyond my realm of understanding of how that works, but fundamentally the way I view it or I understand it is that if there's 100% capacity in the line and the Bonneville Power Administration signs a capacity agreement with five entities to use 100% of that capacity, each one then has somewhere between 0 and 20% or whatever that capacity is, and then that's the capacity that's subject to tax.
And then the follow-up question with regard to the number of counties. Mr. Chair, we've been told that there are 17 counties, I think, that are involved here. We need to know the amount of property taxes that have been collected historically and over how many years on the Intertie, on this particular portion of the Northwest Intertie.
Well, if I understand the testimony, that money comes in as a portion of taxes on the entire entity. And that might be, you might have the same difficulty separating that out as you would separating it out as a whole.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Butler, in most circumstances we do not know the discrete amount per county. In some circumstances we do, for example with Seattle, Tacoma, and Snohomish last session. That was the only property they had in Oregon, so we knew that 100% of the property was attributable, whichever county, and was solely attributable to the Pacific Northwest Intertie. In this case, and in the case of the three others that are currently subject to taxation, there is some blending of property, I think, and in most cases, and so we don't know. I was having the conversation yesterday with Sandy and John, and they said that there was no property of the Intertie in Morrill County, for example. So that answers that question. If that's correct, then the answer, for example, is that there would be nothing in Morrill County. But I don't know. We typically don't sort that out because we don't have to. So we certainly could, but we don't currently.
Mr. Chair, I think we need to know that amount because if we're saying there'd be losses to counties, how would we ever make that calculation?
Thank you. Would you attempt to determine what you can about that question if and when the bill is taken up again?
Sure.
I have a different kind of question, and that is based on your recollection from last time when the three Washington companies were exempted out. Was there a legal nexus problem that the state was considering as to whether or not we had the right to tax those entities? I'm getting a head shake from Gil. Do you want to try that one?
Well, Mr. Chair, we were on the other side of Senate Bill 31, did not want to see it pass. I don't recall there was any impediment to the, and I recall...
You understand the question I'm asking?
I do indeed.
It has to do with the issue of whether or not the state had the authority to tax that property.
Yes, and I believe there was no constitutional or legal impediment to the state doing that.
Thank you.
It was a political choice.
Thank you. Yes.
Mr. Chair, we were neutral on that bill. However, because of our position with the assessment, we were in litigation with at least two of those entities. We were in a second of three phases. The first phase was whether or not there was the authority of the Department of Revenue under the laws of the state of Oregon to assess that property, and that was upheld. The second issue was whether or not there were any federal constitutional issues. After that, you're probably getting beyond my experience.
And we never got to that.
We never got to that because of the legislation passed.
And Mr. Chair, it's my recollection that the property taxes that were being assessed against the three municipalities in Washington were being held in escrow at the time.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, they had never actually, well, one entity, the Snohomish, had paid one tax year of the, I think, 8 years that had been assessed. The other two entities hadn't paid any of the tax years.
Right. Thank you. Is there anything else? Thank you very much, gentlemen. We appreciate it. We're closing the public hearing on House Bill 2793. And we are adjourned.